All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Werke, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is February 29. February 29 only happens once every 4 years. February 29, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar today. The first is A230703 Forencam. I hope I pronounced that correctly, versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, you're familiar with our proceedings. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. These matters are being recorded. That's the only recording that is permitted today. Please state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. Let us know how we can reference you this morning. With that, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, Cody Forencam. This case has the anatomy of a wrongful conviction, and this court must reverse and remand for a new trial for any of the reasons referenced in our brief. I'd like to start with the expert testimony issue. The district court abused its discretion because its rationale for excluding the expert was not supported by the record and was contradicted by all factual and legal authorities submitted to the court and to this court. Every exclusion of expert testimony in Minnesota has to stand on its own two feet. The Minnesota Supreme Court recognized in State versus Miles that expert testimony on eyewitness identifications can be helpful to a jury in a particular case. And so the issue before this court is not some broad policy question about eyewitnesses or experts. The issue is whether this judge, in this case, based on this record and for the reasons she gave, abused her discretion when she excluded the expert testimony. And in this case, she did. It's an abuse of discretion because the district court thought that everything this expert, who had multiple advanced degrees and had spent decades studying this issue, offered 90 pages of proffer at a pretrial hearing and a detailed report. The district court thought everything she said was already known to the jurors and was common sense. And
is that a credibility determination? I mean, what, when we talk about the district court's discretion in making evidentiary rulings, which the district court clearly has, is it your position that the district court is required to accept the proffer on its face, mm-hmm. as opposed to making an assessment as to whether as to the merits of the proffer?
Definitely not, Your Honor. The district court in this case expressly found the expert credible. And I don't have the cite for that, but I will get it for you on rebuttal. It is in the order.
I remember, it is
in the order denying the constitutional motion. So this is not a credibility issue. The district court didn't say the expert was not telling the truth. The district court said the expert was telling the truth, but everybody already knows that.
What in your view is the most troubling aspect of the district court's exercise of discretion? Because there were a number of sort of components that the district court went through in its analysis. Yep. I'm interested to hear what you're most concerned about, you know, your top one or two.
Sure. I have two. The top one, which is multiple parts, because I'm a lawyer, I always have multiple parts, is that what I just said. So finding that people know that cross-racial identifications are less likely to be accurate than same-race identifications, the district court said people know that. People do not know that. The science, the social science is clear that people do not know that. The district court, the expert said that a witness's confidence factor is not correlated with accuracy. People do not know that. That's probably the number one thing that lay jurors look for, is how confident is the witness in her identification. People don't know that. The district court said they do. So the expert could correct that. There are other errors of law that the district court made. So the lineup, for example, and this is the second thing, Your Honor, my second biggest concern, is the district court said, well, you can't challenge the lineup because I already ruled that he doesn't stand out, that's the word she used, that he doesn't stand out in the lineup and that it didn't violate his constitutional rights to bring in the lineup. And that is simply an error of law. Crane versus Kentucky has been clear for decades that there are two different issues. One is the admissibility of the lineup and whether it was whether the identifications were obtained in violation of the defendant's constitutional rights. The district court here said they were not, and that's fine. We can live with that decision. But the second thing is the jury's evaluation of the weight to give the identifications that come from that lineup. And under Crane, the defendant is allowed to present all kinds of evidence. In Crane, it was about a confession, not a lineup, but the same thing is true. The defendant is allowed to present evidence, including, when appropriate, expert testimony, about that lineup so the jury can evaluate not whether it was so unfair as to violate the defendant's due process rights, but whether it was unfair enough to cast a reasonable doubt on the accuracy of the identifications that came from it. And the district court here shut that down hard. Twice during her order, she said, I've already ruled on that. I've already ruled on that. And that was at the state's suggestion. The state argued that she had already ruled on that. And so that was no longer an issue for the jury. And that is simply not true. The key thing an expert can do, and the most important thing an expert can do, is take what jurors think is common sense and explain why that's, in fact, not true. So what sometimes is referred to as counterintuitive truths. And that's the case when the state offers an expert to talk about the behaviors of sexual assault victims, for example. People think that if you were really assaulted, you would call the police right away. And the state calls an expert to say, actually, that's not true. Most people who are assaulted do not call the police right away. And so they're not there to say this particular victim was sexually assaulted or wasn't sexually assaulted. And this expert was very clear that she would not say these identifications were accurate or inaccurate. In fact, in the proffer, the evidentiary proffer at the pretrial hearing, she said she talked several times about the ultimate fact finder. That's a decision for the ultimate fact finder. What she would do is the same thing that experts in all kinds of other social science and hard science fields do, which is provide the jury with information and education to allow them to make the ultimate decision. And so even if some of the basics here are sort of common sense, like, well, sure, memory fades over time, or, well, sure, if someone's got a disguise on, it's going to be harder to identify them. The amicus brief, I think, talks very helpfully about how the key is the degree to which that is true. And we have a really interesting record here because the district court did allow defense counsel to voir dire prospective jurors on what they thought about eyewitness identifications and their accuracy. And their answers are really telling. So the defense lawyer asked prospective jurors why they thought people were misidentified in police investigations. That question was allowed. And the answers were, on page 77, this is volume 3 of the transcript, it's January 19th. Well, the eyewitnesses are probably elderly or have cognitive issues. Or that's page 77. On page 78, a prospective juror said, well, the eyewitnesses were probably affected by drugs or alcohol. Nobody says, well, what race was the eyewitness? What race was the suspect? Nobody says, was the suspect wearing a hoodie? Nobody says anything that experts and scientists know affects the accuracy of an identification. The same thing is true for memory. So, of course, everybody knows memory fades over time. That's obvious. But what the expert, and again, this was very specific testimony at the evidentiary hearing, it's page 21, what she says is what people don't know is how fast that happens. That we're talking about 2 hours, that 2 hours after an event, your memory starts to fade, that 3 hours it starts to fade, that by 6 hours it's like, unless there's something else going on, really going to be problematic. These identifications were made days after the exchange between the witnesses and the suspect, the man in the red pants. Not hours, days. But if you ask the prospective jurors how long they think it takes memory to fade, At pages 42 and 44 of that voir dire, they're talking about years or months. Juror tells a story of something that happened as a child and how his memory faded now that he's an adult. So, of course, nobody knows this because, of course, they don't. Lay people don't know this. Maybe some judges know it. And so when you have a case like State versus Mosley that the state relies on, when the Minnesota Supreme Court said, well, that expert wouldn't have been particularly helpful. Mosley's a court trial. The trained and experienced trial judge who sits as the fact finder in that case can bring his, it happens to be a him in that case, can bring his life experience and knowledge into that. Lay jurors don't have that. They just don't.
Mr. Butler, if I could just jump you ahead, I want to spend a moment talking about prejudice.
Yes.
Before you run out of time. Mm-hmm. And I have a few questions regarding prejudice. First, are you asserting that the district court's abuse of discretion rose to the level of a constitutional violation?
Yes, in the sense that it denied the defendant his constitutional right to present a defense. So, yes. Did you have another question?
So you relied on the Hakala case, and it seems like in your brief you're suggesting that sort of notwithstanding a constitutional violation, when a district court wrongly excludes proffered expert testimony, the reviewing court has to apply a constitutional error standard in assessing prejudice, and I'm just hoping you can talk about that a little.
Sure. So in Hakala, that's exactly what this court did. That the issue in Hakala was wrongful denial of a defense expert. The court said the standard was whether the verdict was surely unattributable to the error, must be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury would have reached the same verdict had the expert been able to testify. The key thing, and so the standard, so that puts, you know, under that standard, the burden is really on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the verdict would have been the same even if the expert had testified. Whether that works on paper or reality, the important thing is what you can't do is undersell what the expert would have done. You have to assume, and this is from Delaware versus Van Arsdale, you have to assume that the damaging potential of the wrongfully excluded evidence would have been fully realized.
Can you turn to the suppression issue?
Sure.
The way I read your, and I'll tell you why this bothers me, the way I read your briefing and your argument, it suggests that any interrogation when you are in custody is inadmissible. And that's what bothers me, because I read this and I go, this individual was fully Mirandized, and aren't we really looking at whether it was the coercion aspects of it or the, mm-hmm. the Miranda analysis versus whether he was in custody or not? I mean, he could have been serving a jail sentence for his assault that was in Carrollton County or wherever it was, and so mm-hmm. what if they show up and they say, look, we want to talk to you about something, and they don't talk to him about the assault, they're talking about something else, and he goes, hey, yeah, I'll talk to you, and this is what bothers me. I feel like you've raised it to a different level, that if you're in custody, if you are in custody, that you can't be interrogated.
No, Your Honor, and I apologize for any confusion, because that's not our argument. Our argument is that Mr. Forenkamp was in custody illegally. He wasn't serving a jail sentence.
But what difference does that make if he was Mirandized? Because it had nothing to do with the investigation that was being undertaken.
That's the point. So he was in. So under the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in McDonnell Richards, which is decided in 2013, what the court said is that when a suspect is in custody illegally, the statement obtained during the interrogation that happens during the illegal custody can be fruit of that poisonous tree, and is fruit of that poisonous tree, including when, like in McDonnell Richards, the suspect is Mirandized. The suspect in McDonnell Richards was Mirandized. And the Supreme Court said, not good enough. We have a multi-factor test we're going to look at, because what we're really looking at is it's a fruits analysis. It's the constitutional violation here is not the statement was obtained in violation of Mr. Forenkamp's Miranda rights. I don't have that argument because he was Mirandized. The constitutional violation is that he was unlawfully seized and detained because a judge ordered him released and no one released him.
But we don't have any record evidence of what the basis was for that. I mean, it's argued by respondent that, gee, you know, you process out, you're in front of a judge at 10 o'clock, and by the time you get back, maybe you're going to hang out for lunch. I don't know what the circumstances are, but it takes time to process. You aren't just let go from the courthouse.
Well, and that the lack of a record, Your Honor, should be held against the state, because it's the state's burden at a suppression hearing to prove that the warrantless detention was constitutional. And so if the state had evidence to show some constitutional basis to hold Mr. Forenkamp, it could have presented that. I don't know the processing, the quote-unquote processing, is not a thing that's ever been accepted in Minnesota, as far as I know, as a reason to hold someone without judicial approval. But even if it was, there's no evidence that that's what was going on here. None. The state didn't call the jail administrator from the Carlton County Jail to testify to their policies. The state didn't call sheriff's deputies to explain that they were trying to get Mr. Forenkamp's stuff together and get him out the door. The state didn't do anything. And Mr. Forenkamp, as you can see in the video, is just sitting in an interrogation room an hour and 10 minutes after a judge ordered him to be released. He's not being, if he's being, he's not being
from
processed.
From the court pronouncement of the order that you're released.
When the judge ordered him to be released, yes. Actually, it's more than an hour after.
I understand that, but that's where we're talking about this timetable in terms of how much time transpired between the court hearing and when he was interrogated.
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. Can I respond quickly to Judge Werke?
Of course.
So just to clarify the record, Your Honor, Judge Lukasiewicz in Carlton County orally ordered Mr. Forenkamp to be released in the morning.
All right, do we agree that somewhere I have 1 hour and 8 minutes. Do we agree that that's the time?
We agree that that is the minimum time, yes. From the written order to when the interrogation happened, yes.
Mr. Butler, we'll see you in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the state.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Deshaun Hill was a 15-year-old student at Minneapolis North High School who was senselessly murdered as he walked home from school.
We get all that because these issues are important. Can you reflect on the last conversation we were having with Mr. Butler in terms of the custodial nature of the interview? That's the part of this that I can't put together in my head.
So appellant relies heavily on the 2013 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, McDonald v. Richards. In that case, the defendant, McDonald Richards, was released from custody after that first post-Miranda interview. That's why she was illegally seized there. There was not probable cause at the time of that post-Miranda interview to arrest her for anything. In stark contrast, when the investigators spoke with appellant in the afternoon of February 16th, 2022, they had clear probable cause to arrest appellant for the murder that had been committed a week before, and in fact told appellant that at the conclusion of their 20-minute conversation with him.
Was that argument presented to the district court, the probable cause argument?
I don't know. I put it in my brief here, and I think that if you look at the language, and I can quote directly from McDonald Richards, the Supreme Court wrote in that case that there is no dispute in this case that McDonald Richards' Fourth Amendment rights were violated when the police seized her without probable cause. That's at page number 16. There was no objective basis for a reasonable officer to conclude that there was probable cause for her arrest. That's page 16 to 17. That's what they're describing about that case.
But so this, seems to be a sort of a different issue than was considered by the district court, the probable cause issue. I'm not seeing in the district court's order, you know, that it had the opportunity to consider that issue, and I understand it's a question of law, but I'm just trying to determine whether this was presented to the district court and, you know, whether, you know, there's sufficient information for this court to make that determination now.
I think it's implicit in the record that's available below. I mean, if you look at Judge Allen's order, I think 12, 13 pages, she does talk about, as Judge Werke was discussing before, the fact that there was that clear Miranda advisory and the waiver of all the rights and then the conversation that ensued. And the record is silent as to how long it takes for an individual to be processed out. If you hone in on document index number 28 in this appeal, which is that pretrial lease agreement from Carlton County. I mean, you zoom as close in as you can to the judge's e-signature at the bottom of that. I think it says about 1:30 p.m.
But, I mean, you would agree that the state has a burden of proof on this issue, right?
The state has the burden of proof to show there was, I mean, yes, that the Fourth Amendment rights were not violated.
And this was a stipulated case that was presented to the district court. You didn't have testimony. Nobody came in from Carlton County to talk about their processes. Nobody came in to talk about what the officers knew at the time that they interviewed.
Well, they clearly knew everything that they wrote in the probable cause statement, with the exception of the references to the conversation that appellant had with them. And it's critically...
Is the record sufficient for us to make that determination now? And if so, where do we go?
You look at the complaint. The complaint was filed the following week after within the minimum period of time required. And the complaint lays out...
The week after the conversation at the jail.
Correct, because of the three-day President's Day weekend that happened. So it was the following Tuesday, February 22nd, 2022, is when the complaint was formally filed. And you look at the information in the complaint, it's referring to information that the police knew about, and we know this from lots of different places in the record, but that the investigators knew about at the time that they spoke to appellant on the afternoon of February 26th. So that information was known to them, and that, I guess, returning to my previous argument, is why it's good they had probable cause, and they said that to appellant during the interview. So I guess in terms of, I understand that there was no witnesses that were called about the processing out procedures.
Well, okay, so the judge says there's no evidence in the record as to why defendant had not been released or whether this was an unusual length of time. Appellant counsel is saying you had a burden of bringing forth that information. What's your response?
I don't think we had a burden to bring forth that information. I think if you look at Judge Allen's findings in that particular ruling on the order, she talks about it's not unreasonable or not unexpected for the processing out. And as this court all knows, having sat as district court judges before, that judges can, you know, make determinations or factual findings based on their own familiarity with the system, saying that it can take multiple hours for someone to be processed out of a jail. That is just what's typical. I believe she says 3 to 4 hours. I do not have the exact page number in front of me right now, but I believe she says that as a finding in her record, that would not be unreasonable. This is obviously within in that 3 to 4 hour time range.
Can we talk about the expert testimony issue, counsel? I'm a little concerned, or maybe a lot concerned, that when you have a situation where the jurors have specifically disclaimed the knowledge that could be delivered to them by the expert witness, and the proffer is uncontested, why it isn't an abuse of discretion for the district court to exclude that testimony when it would clearly be helpful to explain to the jury what the basis of, you know, what misconceptions exist with eyewitness identification. I mean, this is the issue in the case, identification.
It is. I haven't heard any assertion that those excerpts from voir dire related to the specific 12 jurors that ultimately decided appellant's guilt. I understand that the jurors said a lot of things. Those jurors may not have ended up as the fact-finding panel that was actually deciding and listening to the evidence as it came in about the different lineups.
I mean, I presume all the jurors were there at the same time. I don't remember if they were.
I've definitely heard someone say something in a room that I don't agree with, Your Honor.
Right. So.
So, and I don't think Mr. Butler, with all due respect, is giving jurors enough credit in terms of the what they may understand about those seven different topics, if I can use that word, that were identified at appellant's trial counsel's motion for the admission of the expert testimony. And right, the hurt.
Are you saying that it wasn't helpful to the jury?
I think that it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Allen to find that was not helpful enough to be admitted. No, I think trial judges have an immense amount of discretion in these matters, particularly with expert testimony. And that's consistent with every controlling decision that's been issued by this court or the Supreme Court. And that's what Judge Allen was following. She took over 7 minutes for her to go through that ruling that spans page 116 to 130 in the third volume of the trial transcript. And she went through each of those specific circumstances.
I mean, it seems like some of her discussion about this particular issue is internally inconsistent. She's talking about how the expert was providing information which she called science-y, which is certainly not within the lay knowledge of a juror, right? Science-y information is, by definition, not within the lay knowledge of a juror.
Let's talk specifically about the cross-racial identification, because I heard that was being one of the two topics in response to Judge Gaetis's question that Mr. Butler said that he was most troubled by. I believe that the finding that Judge Allen reached in deciding why that particular topic did not justify the expert testimony is that the information that was proffered both in the evidentiary hearing and in the 13-page report was confusing. I'm going to quote from a sentence in that report. The ratio of mistaken identification to correct rejections and target absent arrays was 56% greater for other race identifications. That is a mouthful. I mean, I don't understand what it is, and I've read it five times.
To interrupt there, I mean, this person was going to be called as a live witness, right? And both parties were going to have the opportunity, if she had been permitted to be a witness, to question her and to, you know, ensure that her testimony was clear to jurors. I mean, was it an abuse of discretion for the district court to cite to a particular, pull out a portion of the report that may have been confusing and say, I'm not going to allow this witness to testify because I'm confused by the report, this part of the report?
I think jurors were confused by more than just that. And I mean, another criticism that I hear is that the expert would have testified about the specific identifications that were done in this case. All the summarizing of the studies that have been done nationwide on cross-racial identification had nothing to do with the particular identifications in this case. That's the takeaway from that long list of Supreme Court cases in which, I mean, the general information, you know, from all over the place is not nearly as important as the actual specific facts and circumstances that happened with the photo ID lineups here, and the expert would not have been adequately helpful. At the same time,
Judge Allen concluded that it is within the common knowledge of jurors that cross-racial identifications are not as accurate. What does that mean? I mean, is that the same as having an expert provide numbers to show, you know, how inaccurate those cross-racial identifications are?
That's a factual finding that she made that I think this court needs to afford discretion to, and understand the information that the expert proffered, again, both in that hearing and in the record. But that is a matter of the judge's opinion that then guided her decision about whether or not to exercise her discretion to admit this testimony. And I can't emphasize enough that it's not the question shouldn't be framed as whether or not Judge Allen abused her discretion. It's whether or not she was essentially required, based on the facts of this case, but required by law to admit that expert testimony. I'm not aware of any decision from this court or from the Minnesota Supreme Court that has required a trial judge to admit a particular expert testimony as a matter of law.
Could you address prejudice on this issue, please?
Yes. I touch on it in my brief, but I think that it comes down to a lot of the criticisms of the eyewitness identifications that were made, both the ones that resulted in positive identifications, the two positive identifications of appellant, as well as the ones that resulted in not positive identifications of the appellant. The jury heard all of those facts from the people that actually conducted the identification procedures from the investigators and from the witnesses, the lay witnesses. And then there was extensive cross-examination, pulling out all of these criticisms of the investigators, particularly when appellant's trial team did not think that the investigators had adhered to best practices. And as the prosecutor openly admitted in his closing argument, the investigators did not adhere to absolute best practices in terms of documenting it exactly as the policy says. But at the same time, that information, going back to harmlessness or prejudice, was all in front of the jury. They heard all of that. And it was extensively cross-examined and argued in closing argument as to why the identifications were flawed for a lot of those same factors that they've been identified as would have been fodder for the expert. So that information was out in front of the jury, both in the form of evidence and then in the form of argument in closing. And they still took them only 51 minutes because identifications were one part of the evidence. It was not the only part of the evidence in the case. It took the jury less than an hour to convict appellant of this crime. I have a little bit less than 2 minutes left. I want to
ask you about the prosecutor's comments and closing argument.
I was going right there, Judge Frisch.
What
thank you.
What is the possible probative value of injecting race into this trial?
Race was not
a loaded question, given the way that I phrased it.
But oral argument is.
Go ahead.
Race was not injected into the trial by the prosecutor. This is the way that two witnesses, who both were African American, chose to describe the dialect, the syntax, the speaking style, the tone of the person they encountered in the red pants.
So I'll push back on that a little bit. When I read the cross-examination or the examination of these witnesses, it appears as though it is purposefully elicited from these witnesses, that they were reluctant to talk about the suspect's dialect and then were pushed to give an answer that would elicit that testimony.
I would actually disagree with that assessment of the record. Let's look at Russell James. He openly said he was talking hip, and that was a word that then the prosecutor followed up, and what do you mean by hip? And there was a back and forth, none of which had any objections that were made to it. It was only until the hip was, I think, mentioned a second or third time that there was an objection based on speculation or basis of knowledge, as opposed to injecting race. And before we even get to the way that you framed the question, Judge Frisch, I think you need to get past Rosberg, you need to get past Hull, and the fact that this was not preserved in the way that the rules of evidence, as interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, require it to be preserved. It should be a plain error review on the prosecutorial error argument that's been raised on appeal, because the words injecting race into the trial were never mentioned anywhere in the record below. I see that I'm out of time. I'm happy to address any other questions. Otherwise, I'd simply ask for this court to affirm.
Anything else on the panel? No. All right, thank you very much. Mr. Butler, you'll have the last word.
Thank you. I wanted to start with Judge Frisch's question about credibility. I did find it. It's the Rasmussen order from January 17th, 2023, page 3, finding of fact number 1. Expert, all witnesses would be the expert, were credible. To Judge Gaetis's question about prejudice, counsel said a couple times that there was evidence that the defense could use to counter the eyewitness identifications, and that's just not true. That's exactly what the expert would have offered. Defense counsel's argument to the jury is not evidence about the accuracy of IDs. It's true that the jury heard the bare facts of what made up the identifications, but that's exactly what the expert was going to do. And that's what experts do, is they help juries who are given bare facts. Here was the lighting conditions, here was the hoodie wore, and help them determine what to do with those facts and how much weight to give them and what else to be concerned about and whatnot. There was none of that. Defense had none of that. In particular, the expert could also have provided evidence contrary to the evidence that existed from the two homicide detectives who testified. Those two homicide detectives were questioned, as counsel said, about their inability to follow the police department policy, and the Minneapolis police policy on paper seems to be pretty good for lineups. But the evidence they gave was that policy's stupid. You're right, I don't follow it. Flawed. That policy's flawed is what one of the policemen said. They both said, I've been doing this for 15 years. I know how to get an accurate lineup. I don't need to follow the policy. That's the evidence. And the only thing before the jury then is that these trained homicide detectives are not going to worry about this nitpicking that that defense counsel is doing about you follow every word in the policy. Everybody who has a job has to follow some policies. And every juror goes back to that room and is like, God, I don't like it when my boss gets on me for not following every three words of the policy.
So if I could just focus you very specifically on prejudice concerns that I'm having.
Yes.
You've got 2 of 5 positive IDs through the identification process. And you've got a killing that was on video. And so, you know, all shown to the jurors, you know, so the jurors could sort of make their own conclusions as to the identity of the individual who was responsible. How was the denial of the expert testimony in light of that evidence reversible?
It's reversible, Your Honor, because the video is, I'm not going to say irrelevant, it's irrelevant to the issue of identity. You cannot see the face of the shooter on the video. Everybody agrees with that. The state agrees with that. I'd encourage you to watch the video of the shooting itself. You cannot see. You can see it's a man in red pants.
Well, I've seen the videos,
yeah.
And there are other things beyond the face that, you know, are arguably identifying.
The red pants. Yeah, you mean...
Well, in comparison with some of the other videos that were played as well,
but
where
there's no,
face of the appellant was visible.
There's no other videos of my client wearing red pants. There's no videos of my client changing from gray pants into red pants. There's no witness who says my client changed from gray pants into red pants. The state's theory is that he fell in the snow and then changed his pants. I don't know if that's possible, but no one saw that. These folks had exchanges with a man in the red pants, and that's what this trial was about. But there's no other evidence besides those 2 identifications that you mentioned, Your Honor. There's no other evidence that that's my client in the red pants. That's why this matters. That's why it matters so much to have the expert come in to talk about the most important. I think Judge Fritsch said this case was about the identifications. And the question, this is not a, obviously not a sufficiency challenge. And if you can look at whatever standard for harmless error you want to look at. But this is if you follow Hakala and you say the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that had the full damaging potential of this expert been realized beyond a reasonable doubt, we know the verdict would be the same, where there's no other evidence the defense can use to challenge the most important evidence in the case, I don't think you get there. And I think you particularly don't get there because, as Judge Frisch said earlier, we know what these particular jurors were thinking about eyewitness identification. We had a juror, or memory, for example. On page 41, a juror said that if she sees something, her memory is her memory, and quote, I know what I saw. And on page 41, she's then asked, what if you were presented with contrary evidence? And the juror said, I saw what I saw, and I would worry about why that other person was wrong. That's how people think about eyewitness identifications. And that's why the expert was so important. I apologize for going over time. We ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel?
No.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, counsel, for your very helpful arguments and submissions. The matter is submitted, and you will receive an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you.